Welcome to Slayer Fest 98. I'm your host, Ian Carlos Crawford.
And I'm your other host, Matthew Rodriguez. And we are joined today by two very special guests. We have the author of White Rabbit and the forthcoming Death Prefers Blondes, Caleb Rearig.
Yay. Hello, greetings.
Did I say your last name wrong?
No, you said it right.
I said it right? Oh my god, that was my first try, I think.
It rhymes with Carrig.
Honestly, yeah, it's just like Meryl Streep, I'm good at everything, so.
First take, Matthew.
And I've been watching a lot of Mamma Mia this week. I've watched it 3 times in the past week. Sorry.
Oh, that's a good life choice.
And, of course, a fellow YA author and Slayer Fest 98 executive producer, Adam Sass.
Hello. I am. It's still technically a season premiere-ish, so I'm still a season premiere queen.
It's the real season premiere.
I mean, Buffy versus Dracula is a fabulous, like, I don't want to say prologue. Is that?
Well, you know what's funny? It is like a prologue because, and then there are people who fight. Like, I once had someone try to fight me to say, like, Restless isn't the season finale of 4. It's like an epilogue. So it's this epilogue-prologue thing.
Yeah, Restless and Buffy Dracula, they live in these sort of little, I don't know, nebulous worlds. It's a weird crossing point.
They're season non-conforming.
Exactly. Well, because the story, they have their own self-contained story that sort of contributes to the overall arc of their respective seasons, but the actual narrative arc of season 4 concludes before Restless, and it starts after Dracula.
Yeah. So today we're here to discuss season 5's The Real Me, where we learn all about Dawn. And also, this episode, Caleb becomes an official Scooby because it's his third episode. So yay!
Yay, series regular.
I know, it's time for me to update series, my Twitter bio.
He's in the credits.
Speaking of which, by the way, like, this is what season 5 is about, when the Buffy credits start to get like a little top heavy, where it's like 70 people. It's like James Marsters, Allison Hannigan, the Green Bay Packers.
When does it start? Like, when
they
does
have
it
to
start?
They add Dawn, Anya, and Riley's still there. Uh-huh. And he's not going to leave until midway. So right now, at this point in season 5, it takes a little long in the tooth.
Yeah. And frankly, it's so long, but they're still doing Tara dirty by not putting her in there.
I know.
If we ever really do get Tara on the show, I want to know if she like had meetings with producers where they were like, "Ooh, we promise you're gonna get a promotion like soon," and then like she just kept being like, "What the fuck? I'm not in the like the yes. moment." The moment Riley was out of the credits, they should have put Tara in.
I think when they had the conversation where they're like, "Hey, we're gonna kill Tara," she's like, "You have one episode to put me in the credits."
Well, Joss said that he always wanted to do something where he put someone in the credits and killed them the same episode, and he was going to do it with Jesse in the first episode in Welcome to Hellmouth.
But they didn't have the budget.
Yeah. So,
interesting.
Because I think when you're in the credits, you have to pay the person more, too.
Yeah.
They didn't have money to give Jesse for like being in the credits, because you're a principal and not a guest star. So I don't know. Tara needs that. Amber Benson needs that series regular money. Yeah.
If I ever find out,
it wasn't even a lot of money. Like at this point, Sarah Michelle Gellar wasn't even making like $75,000 an episode.
Wow. Jesus.
She never like the most she made in season 7 was like $80,000.
Oh my gosh.
Per episode.
Listen,
yeah.
The WB, y'all. It just the book about the WB is going to happen in like 20 years. It's going to be like, wow, what a teen talent farm.
It's gonna be the fire fury of TV books.
It's gonna be Holly Marie Combs writing it. And
oh my god, stan Holly Marie Combs.
I know, right? Oh yeah, I want to read that tell-all. I want to read the Charmed. I want to hear all the dirt. Oh.
If it were a Charmed tell-all, I would trust Holly Marie Combs' version of events the most.
Yes. 100%. 100%.
Honey, you read my mind, because I was thinking that I was like, God, you know, everybody else, I don't know, question mark. But like Holly Marie Combs, like, she sees purely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And her and Charisma Carpenter are such good friends, so I feel like they're both really great.
All right, so let's start talking about this episode.
Okay.
So it opens with Buffy training, which is a really cool coda from the end of the last episode where she talks to Giles. and says that she wants to train again. So it starts with her training, and Dawn interrupts the training, and she falls over.
So in the commentary, I watched the DVD with the commentary. It's David Fury and David Grossman. And I couldn't tell them apart because their voices were very, like, laid-back, straight white dude. They say that the opening of the episode is part of their plan for the rest of the season to show Buffy, like, to show rather than tell Buffy expanding her Slayer talents. And that's why they wanted to show her doing something different, like being, you know, upside down. And they said they shot the scene off-speed, which I have no idea what that means. Maybe you guys do.
Off-speed?
Yeah.
All on speed.
And then they talk about it.
Nice, yeah.
I could conjecture that it has something to do with the frame rate, but I...
Yeah, that's what I think they mean.
Right? Yeah.
And then they talk about...
a little slower and calmer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they talk about, like,
it sounds like a made-up dude term. I went to film... This is something made.
And they talk about how, like, even the camera work that was different for them, like, for what they normally did on the show, and it is different. Yeah.
Well, it does look like Enya should be playing.
Yeah.
But one thing I wanted to point out is that I don't know where they're training, because it actually does look a little bit like the back of the magic box.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But he does not yet own the magic box.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
No, unless wait, you're right. That isn't just, yeah.
You don't know about.
That's a good point.
I mean,
because he basically recreates that in the back of the magic box. Like, it's fairly accurate.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure lots of times they just were like, I mean, Joss in the book, like the Slayers of Vampires, Joss always says how low their budget was and how they had to reuse things. So I'm sure it probably turned into the back set of the magic box. you know, I'm sure they were like, let's just make it look a little brighter. I think that this is also, I mean, I mentioned this in Buffy vs. Dracula, it's also a really brief opening, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
It's just the imbalancing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, then we get the credits, and actually during the credits, the two guys in the commentary say that originally Dawn was envisioned and written as a 12-year-old girl, but then when Michelle read for the part, Joss liked her immediately and cast her, and David Fury says how in his writing... The 12-year-old, he thinks that, like, 12-year-old Dawn sneaks through, and I very much agree. Like, her opening writing in her journal feels like a 12-year-old, not however old they say she is, which they don't quite make so clear.
She's 14.
Okay. They identify
the middle schooler.
I would say that they absolutely, in this episode for sure, they treat her as a 12-year-old, and she behaves as a 12-year-old, but it makes sense for her to be older than that for a lot of reasons.
I think it's almost like a weird psychological thing, right? Like, they, like, this group of people knows how much darker the world is than we do, in a way, because they're dealing with all this dark shit. So I think they infantilize Dawn even further because they need to protect her from the fact that there's, like, real world monsters.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's weird watching them treat her like such a literal child because... it really ages everybody, because especially since this is the first season where, I mean, yeah, they're in college a bit, you know, but this is the first season that's really free of a school feel.
Yes.
And
this is the one where, like, even when I watch now as a 29-year-old, I feel like they're older than me still.
Oh, especially, well, I mean, when you get to season 6, where she's literally worried about, like, the water bill. there's right. There's a jump in time.
But yeah, but there's something very, very like adult about Buffy and Riley's relationship as it's depicted in this episode in particular. Yeah, and I also the thing that kept sticking. So of course in this episode the actors keep turning directly to the camera and saying Dawn's been here the whole time, but. She has this line where they talk about how Dawn is 14, and Buffy keeps talking about how nobody coddles me and nobody shielded me. And I'm thinking, and it occurred to me that Buffy was 14 when she became the Slayer, when she was first approached, that was Dawn's age.
Yeah.
That divide, the way that they really do infantilize her, really sticks out.
Well, I think I would usually wait until we get there to talk about it, because I'm a stickler for chronology, but yeah, I do want to bring it up now, because... It actually feels like the series changes it changes Buffy's mind a lot about whether or not she wants to shield Dawn or not, because there's sometimes where she's mad that Dawn is shielded, and then she gets upset that but then she tries to shield Dawn. Like, you know, she says in this episode, like, we're turning her into an idiot who's going to get us all killed. Like, at that moment, she can decide to tell Dawn about how to protect herself, but she doesn't really make that decision until the end of season six. Yeah. When they're in that pit and she's like, I want to show you the world, very, you know, Aladdin style. And but she could have just bypassed 2 years of problems between siblings and been like, you know what, I'll start now.
Well, and also, it's, I mean, you're right, because then she's mad at Dawn for inviting Harmony in and is very like, Dawn should know better, Dawn should, but like, earlier, it's like she wants to shield her from everything.
I know that this is jumping way, way ahead, but given what we know in retrospect about the fact that Dawn was put into Buffy's life specifically to be an object that she protects, this weird kind of like hyper-protective instinct, both from Joyce and from Buffy, makes sense, since that is the whole point, was to turn, you know, the key into something so precious that it would be cherished and protected at all costs.
Yeah.
So I get the I think that the psychology reflects that, but it is jarring in the sense that the world that these people navigate is so, like, in this episode, moving forward just slightly in time, when they go to the magic box and they stumble over a corpse, and immediately they're like, oh, get Dawn out of here, she can't look at a dead body. And it's like, the town is piled, like, neck deep in dead bodies, like, all the time.
Well, like, how could she have made it through? I mean, if this is retconning Dawn into the whole history, how could she have made it through four seasons?
Yeah.
Without seeing a dead body. I mean, the dead man's party. Everybody broke into the house, dead bodies everywhere.
There were dead bodies everywhere.
Literally everywhere.
There were dead bodies that were dead and dead bodies that were alive.
Oh, double dead. Yeah, it's, I always do like a fun game of being like, okay, well, what if this one, you know, just, I'm like, this is clearly a writing flaw a little bit, but I'm like, well, what if it wasn't a writing flaw? The way you could maybe explain this psychological, sort of like back and forth, she's not making any sense, she's not consistent with how she's treating Dawn, is I kind of maybe look at this as she is jealous that she had to grow up so much faster than Dawn did. Like, so she wants to protect her, but then she's also like super furious at her. Like, and she like, it just making her this really erratic older sibling, where she looks at Dawn and she sees this sort of, you know, girl who was not protected. Yeah.
I think that Sarah Michelle Gellar sells that. I think that she does a really good job of playing a frustrated older sibling, because it's true. She feels like I think a lot of older siblings feel that they get treated harsher than the younger siblings, that they don't get, they never got to get away with what the younger siblings are allowed to get away with.
It's true.
and now she has to be kind of like police force, like Joyce's deputy police force to watch Dawn and protect her. And I mean, and we'll get into this, but oh my gosh, I'm so annoyed by Joyce in this episode because of the way that she keeps basically foisting her responsibilities onto Buffy, and then I think unfairly judging Buffy when things go wrong. She's like, took her to a dead body, and it's like, bitch, you made her. You know your daughter is the Slayer, and you told her to take her little sister with her to the magic shop, where Giles acknowledges everybody gets killed all the time.
She really acts like she went up to, like, a box office and bought two tickets to the dead body to bring, like, her sister.
Like, it was an accident.
Yes.
But let's go back. We don't have to do the whole morning routine with Joyce and Buffy, but we can at least go into Giles and them in his new BMW convertible.
Wait, I wanted to point out before we do that, I love a nerd reference in a nerd show, and I love that when she tells Buffy to bring Dawn with her, she's like, there's nothing she could buy there for school, and Dawn's like, unless I'm going to Hogwarts, and then it's like, geez, read a book, crack open a book sometime. I think that's such good, like, one sister banter, and I love a nerd reference in a already nerdy thing. And it makes sense, because Buffy wouldn't read Harry Potter, but, like, Dawn would.
But Dawn would, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was so, like, this was 2000? Was this 2000 or 2001? Like, this was, yeah, this was definitely, this was, like, this wasn't everybody was reading that shit that time. Yeah. Like, now this would be like, all right, come on. Like, you know what we're talking about here.
Yeah, this would have been 2000, I believe. I think.
It was, yeah, this was September, like, September, October 2000, of 2000.
Yeah. Cool.
No way. Was I still in high school when this? I don't think I
was. Yeah, this was senior year.
Because season 4 ended in 2000, so this would have begun in September, October 2000.
Oh yeah.
Exactly.
Also, how do you all feel? So, I mean, we don't need to go through the steps of this, but how do you feel about the Dawn voiceover throughout the episode? It begins in the beginning, you know.
I have conflicted feelings. I'm pro in the sense that I think they had to do it. I think that they, like, boom, they dropped a little sister on us at the very end of the first episode, and it is this jarring surprise moment. And then I think that they absolutely needed to do it this way in order to introduce us to Dawn. But it's a weird... It's just weird. It's like if Superstar had lasted an entire season and you didn't find out until 10, 12 episodes in what the trick was. You're just you're just plunged cold into this universe where suddenly Jonathan is the hero.
Yeah.
And it is that kind of a... Yeah, it's unmooring in a way, but I think it was a good idea.
Well, I can't imagine... Did anybody watch this live? Like, I watched this how many episodes of, like, frustration was this?
Well, this is the first full episode with Dawn in it, and it's the only one where she gets voiceover.
Mm. Yeah.
So it's very isolated, like, you almost have to say, like, for this episode, it's almost like the musical episode, you have to kind of concede that for this episode they're gonna go a different way. It's almost like a Sex in the City with her as Carrie narrating everything that happened.
It's a Carrie Diaries.
Because I also watched it in real time. And I remember it was very, like, it was very divisive. The whole, like, the introduction of Dawn, it was very divisive at the time because a lot of people found her really annoying and they didn't understand. And she was kind of like the Scrappy-Doo of Buffy where people said, you know, oh, they're just adding in this new younger character in order to appeal to a younger audience and it's not necessary. And personally, I think that clearly this was something that they had been planning. And I think that season 5 was the right time to do it because I think they had earned the audience's trust in following them down this pathway. But yeah, but it was weird. It was very strange.
Yeah, well, because I think they knew they were killing Joyce. And they knew they were breaking her up with Riley. They were isolating her on purpose because they wanted to see what she was going to do solo, and they wanted her to sacrifice herself and save herself, but not for a man and not for any other friend.
Because if you take away Buffy's love interest and you take away her mother, like, they could have had a whole back season of Weight of the World style, like, Buffy would be catatonic. She'd be like, I lost literally everything. Yeah. But she kind of needs some kind of family member to keep her moving and to keep her focused.
Yeah.
We could even do an exercise where we think about, like, because, you know, everyone here is a writer. Some people, and we're all writers, whatever, not exactly TV, but like, there's ways to establish character that are not, oh, and now the character speaks to the audience, you know, one-on-one. Yeah. And it's a little, I mean, like, we are able to get interiority from Xander and Buffy and Willow over time, and we don't need episodes of them narrating.
Totally.
So it's like, there are ways they could have done it, right? But I think what Caleb said is the really interesting tension is, like, there are other ways to do it, but if we want to get it done fast so that we're not waiting 5 or 6 episodes for you to get who Dawn is, this is the shortcut. So it's like a decision. Do we take the shortcut so the audience gets it now, or do we allow 5 or 6 episodes of, like, Dawn having one-on-one conversations with, like, a friend character, or opening up to one of the Scoobies, or even opening up to Tara, since they seem to have, like, a different non-Scooby relationship where we do it slowly.
Yeah.
Can I say, I actually really appreciated her relationship with Tara, because they're both outsiders, and I think that I just because Dawn needed that. I think that there needed to be a sort of a character that everybody loves to love Dawn, like unapologetically and unqualified, because of course everybody, you know, loves Dawn, but she's annoying and they treat her as an annoyance. And Tara is really the only one who never seems to, maybe Willow also, but who never really seems to become irritated by her and displays.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, like, later on, Xander, like, in season 7, Xander would kind of do the whole, like, hey, we're both schmucks, right? Like, and she was kind of super not feeling that kinship with him. I think she had a stronger one with Tara. But.
Yeah, well, but the part of the thing is I think that Tara is sort of the, in a way, she's the Lisa Simpson of Buffy. She's sort of she's sort of the heart and the moral center. She's slow to judge and quick to forgive. And so having her be the one to reach out to Dawn and treat Dawn like an equal or like a person who deserves patience and understanding and compassion, it encourages the viewer to question their own sharp judgment of Dawn.
We can skip over Giles's BMW, though I do think it's really the funny part of that scene is when they see Willow and Tara and he's like, ooh, they need to see my new car.
Yeah.
I really love Anthony Stewart Hedden. I think he does a great job in this episode. It's his stuff is very like low key, but he does a great job.
The befuddled, the fumbling, like just he really leaned into it without making him a kid. Because as the show goes on, everybody kind of becomes a caricature of what they initially had going on, and he's able to find that funny without really making him into this like, my God, suddenly he's this buffoon. Like it still does grow out of this. It's very, very well done. Very well done, Anthony.
So then they go to the magic shop, and they find the dead owner.
Inevitably, I mean, I feel like the magic shop is almost like a Defense Against the Dark Arts.
Mm-hmm. It's yeah. Mm-hmm.
He's the third dead owner they found.
The first one was the Becoming, or no, Passion, when she goes to buy.
Yeah.
Did they kill the owner then?
Yes, and then when Spike comes back in season 3.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Yes. They
the lovers walk.
Do the love spell. The reverse, the love spell. I mean, the more interesting thing of this part is obviously the interaction with the man.
Yeah.
Who does not have his wits about him.
The mind-sucked man. Because
he's... Yeah, so yeah, this is
the question. That's the question. Is Glory already in Sunnydale? Because there's a question as to whether he is just... Yeah. Man who is crazy or whether he is a mind-sucked man.
My read on it, in retrospect, after having watched the season, my read on it was that this is one of Glory's victims.
Yeah.
And I think that because several times, including later with Tara, you see the people who are victims of Glory's mind-suck are the ones who can identify Dawn, specifically. Yeah. Yeah, whatever piece it is that she pulls out of them seems to be the filter that blocks people from being able to identify Dawn.
There was always a question for me about that, because there is that episode, and I don't know exactly which one it is, but maybe it's Out of My Mind, when you know, Glory is actually like chasing the monks and it seems like she just gets there.
No
place. So that's like why I've always questioned as to whether she was there yet or not, because yeah, it seems like she arrives in Sunnydale because the key has only been alive, I guess, for like a week now. So she wouldn't really know it was here. I don't know. So that's, I mean.
As she's in the vicinity. She hasn't super narrowed down Sunnydale yet. She's in the vicinity. She's been on her way wherever she was before. She's been sucking people's minds. And eventually one of them sort of wandered into Sunnydale. Like, I think this is just, you're seeing just a slow move into that.
Because this guy we do see again.
We do?
Yes.
Oh, we do.
She sees him in the hospital. Oh, no. That's the night guard they see again. Never mind. I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Boo. Wrong.
But I do assume that anyone who is acting that way but also knows the little Miss Muffet thing and can see that she's a bright ball of energy. But I guess, also, I guess that theory doesn't work because Joyce sometimes goes in and out of not knowing who Dawn is.
It's true, they've been very, I think, actually consistent on the show saying that it's just anyone whose mind is different than, like, it doesn't have to be someone who was mind sucked by Glory to see the key.
Enough. fair enough, but I prefer to believe that he was mind suck.
Me too.
I
think
we were just talking last episode about sometimes on Buffy, it's just you have to believe what you want to believe, and
yes,
yep.
You know,
as a super fan of Lynch's work, I'm always just like, there's a reason. There's a reason for this.
For those at home playing Slayer Fest 98 Bingo, Adam Sass just brought up David Lynch.
I
put his token down.
Again, you guys are very, very lucky I wasn't in the Restless episode because I would have absolutely monopolized that thing. So, good on you. Good on you.
I had that tweet that said the Twin Peaks and was all the pictures of Willow and the red curtains.
Yes, I understand. Yes, that was good. That was
for you, Adam.
So, I really like one of the things I really like about the man who confronts Dawn is the tone of the whole scene and how quickly it changes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And how much you really feel like Dawn is in danger because he actually touches her, like he puts his finger on her.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's really unsettling, you know.
Yes. I think that they did that on purpose because then it's like Tara walks out and Dawn doesn't say anything. I almost feel like they did that to be like, ooh, maybe something, like maybe she killed him, because at that point, you know, Dawn is like new, and she references in the episode a bunch of times how no one knows the real her, even though she's just being like an overdramatic teenager. As a viewer, you might view it as, ooh, is she like gonna be a villain? Is she plotting?
Well, that's the thing. Like, out of chronology, I actually hate the ending of this episode where they're like, they don't know what I really am.
Yeah.
It's like such a, it's one of the dumbest red herrings I think the show has ever done.
As somebody who watched this episode in real time, that was the worst part, because it was, they had that like haunting musical cue as she says, you know, but they're going to find out, and it led to all this speculation about, oh, she's the big bad for the season, oh, you know, there's this, she's going to turn out to be a demon, she's got some plan in store for Buffy, everybody's been mind wiped, blah blah blah, and it was deceptive, and it led to like a weird viewer relationship with Dawn, which was already, I think, like, you're introducing a character who functions as an annoying brat who consistently sort of makes Buffy's life and job harder, and you're going to end it with, but maybe she's also a villain. And I'm like, I didn't think that was...
It's so awesome. Many directions in one, yes. At one moment.
It's like, this is clearly the, like, Caleb Ward Agatha Christie fan. Like, this is clearly the, like, is this the villain? Is this the killer? And it's like, no, this is, we're way early in the book for this. But,
it's played so dramatically when really she's just writing what anyone would write in their Zanga at that age.
What I wrote in my dead journal at the time.
We can skip over Buffy talking to Joyce because we talked about that and how unreasonable Joyce is being.
Wait, but I did want to point out... So when Tara comes out in the commentary, David Fury says Tara, they like purposely made Tara the one that comes looking for Dawn, not Buffy, because they wanted to portray Tara as quote unquote the good aunt, the like cool aunt you can like talk to.
Mm.
And I do think they like
mission accomplished.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, like, yeah. I feel like they get that, like that scene is what, like so early on, but like they get that immediately with Tara and Dawn where like, that's their relationship, and it will be for the rest of the series.
It's a very consistent relationship. I mean, even when Tara and Willow are broken up, Dawn still goes to see Tara.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's Amber Benson has, like, a tenderness to her in general. Mm-hmm. So her acting lends itself well to that, you know?
Okay. Well, and there's that.
And now I'm just remembering that Dawn is the one who finds Tara's body, and I'm going to just need a moment here.
Oh no!
Well, I'm gonna need a moment. All right, good.
That's, you're trying to ruin me. You're trying to make me cry. Right before I speak, sabotage.
Yes, it is.
You know, I'm gonna tell you, ladies. There's always somebody coming down you behind the stair or behind you down the stairs. That person is Adam.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
I'm just gonna say, yeah, because there's that scene in here where Tara says, you know, she acknowledges that she's not part of the central, like the core Scoobies.
Mm-hmm.
And Willow's like, oh no, yes, you know, you are. And she's like, no, I'm not, and that's fine. And I was, and it's such a grounded moment. Like, it's such a, like, I know my value and I know my place, and you don't have to try to appease me by, you know, like telling me that I'm also part of this group when I'm clearly not. But to try to share that wisdom with Dawn, trying to like make Dawn feel special even though she's not a part of this group, because she understands what it's like to not be a part of it and to sort of be on the periphery.
That's
you know what's interesting is the show gives all of its characters an out for being a part of the group, kind of, because one of the things that Jane Espenson said is that every single character up until this season is an only child. Every single character is an only child, so they never have to worry about talking about their family or their brothers and sisters. And they also are all kind of loners because none of them have friend groups outside of this friend group except for Riley, and his friend group hated Buffy, and then they killed them all. So it's like... so, like, the show is very intentional about, like, because they're, I mean, like, when you're in a relationship, your friend, your boyfriend or girlfriend or partner has their friends, and they can easily hang out with them, and you hang out with your friends, and then you be together or something. But they're very purposeful about, like, not giving Tara friends. Tara should have other friends. She's a lovely woman.
She should have other friends.
She has the witch group.
Right.
Well, I think the witch group didn't even really, I mean, the witch group, they microaggressed her because they made them actual witches, so she didn't feel comfortable.
Well, and they...
The greatest line in that witch group is, like, when someone actually, like, says, hey, we should... It was, like, Willow. She's like, hey, we should do a spell. And she's like, oh, why don't we all get on our broomsticks and ride around on our broomsticks?
Yeah.
It's, like, the greatest line.
So in that moment when they're when she meets up with Willow and Tara, and Willow has a terrible line where she brings up asking if Tara... If Dawn still leads with her knight, which I hate that line... there is a rift. There's a rift in the Buffyverse because Dawn is writing in her diary and says that she once said to Joyce that she wants to know about what Tara and Willow do, and Joyce got uncomfortable. But in the last episode in Buffyverse Dracula, we find out that Joyce does not know that Willow and Tara are lesbians together. Because there's that line where she's like, "Ugh, don't you just feel like giving up on men, girls?"
Yeah, but so
they all have
a girls only night.
But remember, they did this once before. Because in the Dark Age where Cordelia didn't know that Angel was a vampire, but then in Halloween she did. Or something was like, it was like literally like the next episode in which they both appeared, she knew, and there was no scene.
In Halloween, they show Buffy telling Cordelia, because she's like, Cordelia, Angel's a vampire, we thought you knew.
But Cordelia thinks she's like, lying.
Right.
Right. But like, they actually do show her telling, but they never...
Oh, yeah, no, sorry, it was the other way around. Yeah, it was Halloween where they tell her and she doesn't believe them, and then in the Dark Age where the demon jumps into Angel... And Cordelia witnesses it and doesn't have a reaction. Anyway, sorry, that's a totally different thing, but we're talking about...
I think Joyce is being more microaggressive here, where she's probably saying, look, what if she was like, ladies, you want to just, you know, give up a minute? Like, I think maybe like 2% she knows what's going on, and she's that uncomfortable.
Hitting on them. Maybe she wanted to make a throuple. Like, maybe she was like, hey, I'm looking to give up. Who wants to get in on this?
Listen, Joyce was wild and out in season 5. She was just getting her goddamn life back on track. I'm so upset by this.
Honestly, with no Dawn yet and Buffy out of the house, she was probably getting a lot in season 4. She had suitors coming home every night.
Listen, she had two shitty relationships. She deserved it. She should have been. She should have been. Just come on, Joyce. Just notches in the bedpost. Just get it.
Yeah, she had like a robot, and then Buffy's father, who literally doesn't show up for her own funeral. So
a misogynist Bluebeard robot, and then also Buffy's dad, who got worse as the seasons wore off.
Adam, you're right. Like, he literally doesn't even come to her fucking funeral. Like, Jesus.
Like, what a joke on Joyce. Like Joyce is like, oh, I should go fuck myself then. You know, Joyce.
I should go fuck myself.
But let's move on.
Wait, there was something I wanted to... Oh, so, in that scene, I do love the cut to Harmony. When they're like, what was stolen? Oh, they took something. It must have been an artifact. And Willow's like, a unicorn. It was a cheap unicorn. It was $12. And he's like, which begs the question, what kind of unholy creature fancies cheap, tasteless statuary? And just Harmony clapping her hands and smiling.
So great.
Harmony's speech to the minions is great.
So I wanted to say that the way in the commentary, they say they didn't know what to do with Harmony, but they loved Mercedes McNabb. And I mean, she is really great. And so that they decided to write her because they wanted to show that she also progressed in her vampire powers, which we see when she like beats up Xander and Anya. And that the way they made her as the leader of a gang was the way the captain of the prom committee would act.
Yes.
I feel like that's pretty accurate to how they have her be.
So watching the episode the first time, I remember being very like, I wasn't sure, because that was another one where I was like, I wasn't sure, what is Harmony going to be the big bad for this season? And I was kind of like, okay, like, I could see that. It seems a little weird. And I think that Harmony is, she's an annoying supervillain, but in retrospect, like, watching it back, I actually really liked her. I really liked what she brought to this episode, because she really commits to that, like, this sort of, like, cheap, shallow, not terribly bright, like, honestly, how many villains have tried to take out the Slayer, and how many ways have they tried to take out the Slayer? And she kind of comes along with her like disorganized grab bag of minions and decides she's going to do it. She's got her, got her unicorns, and she's going to do it.
Tell me this wouldn't actually have been amazing. I think it would have been amazing if somehow when she got to Sunnydale, Glory would have found Harmony and made her like second in command or something.
Like
if Glory was like, I see myself in you, even though you're like a dumber version of me, like, I'm not gonna go fight this vampire slayer, you are going to go fight her
and it would have been Harmony falling right back into her role with Cordelia when Cordelia
right, because
was
that
the queen.
That's the thing is like, yes, that is, you think she has to be second in command. Like, she can never be the CEO, but she can be the person who like goes out and does things. And I think that there would have been some amazing scenes between Glory and Harmony.
I agree.
Well, she's your asshole middle manager.
Like, she's Machiavelli's lieutenant.
Totally.
AKA.
Yeah. She's Dwight. Like, she can like implement whatever.
Like, if Glory got there, if Glory got there and Harmony was like, I had so much trouble like doing my, like, you know, trying to have lackeys and make plans, like, I can't do that. And Glory was like, well, of course you can't. That's not your lot in life. Like, you're supposed to be a helper. Like, why don't you? I take those lackeys off your hands and you can be my second? Because I also think that the story of Harmony is actually a story about, like, what do you do when you're ambitious, but you're just, your lot in life is that you're supposed to be number two, but you want to be stronger and you want to be better. Like, she would have been attracted to someone as, like, Glory.
Absolutely.
To be, you know?
Yeah. All the power, but none of the responsibility.
But I wanted to point out that Tom Lenk, a.k.a. Andrew...
Is Cirrus.
Is, yeah, in her group. And when, in the commentary, David Fury says, and there's Tom Lenk, is his first appearance in the Buffyverse, and the producer or director David Grossman says, who?
Oh, no.
Girl, come on.
It was just, it's a really, like, it's these two dudes, and he's just like, who? As if it's, like, our parents.
Like, that sounds like two old guy. Like, that's, right. like, oh, yeah. Like, that's crusty. That sounds crusty.
Is that that fag character?
Right, basically.
Oh, gosh.
Like, yeah, I have gay blindness. I can't see.
I don't think
gay blindness.
So, yeah. Okay, so
that... Got that. I want to unhear that. Please edit this out. That's too damaging for the world to hear.
We have the Don Xander moment, which... is very adorable.
Is there a Dawn scene before the life, before they're playing life, or is that the first?
Well, that's when Xander first shows up with the pizza, and right. She is saying in her diary about how she kind of likes him, because they're fighting over who's gonna watch Dawn, and they say Xander, and then she runs and is like, yes, that's who I want to watch me. And then she gets upset when she sees Anya there, and she kind of insinuates that Xander shouldn't be with Anya because he's better than her.
Yeah, that's like, this scene is perfect because Xander is the perfect guy you fall in love with when you're 14, and then you're like,
yes,
wait a minute,
because to a 14-year-old, they don't see him as like this toxic masculinity douchebag asshole.
They just, well, because they see that they see the good guy front. Right. They see the, oh, you're nice, right. You're coming over. They don't see all these crazy microaggressions coming out of him left and right.
Yeah, well, but also, Xander, you know, I mean, he's the immature, like, older dude friend who talks to Dawn like an equal because he's kind of immature. But he, you know, he's like all chummy with her and friendly and irresponsible, and she responds to that. And I totally get it. But yeah, it's like this season, okay, so I started disliking Xander pretty much like immediately. I liked him in season one, but then by the time season two rolled around, I was not feeling it because he had that his temper tantrum at the end of season one, and then in season two, he's a total dick about Angel. Oh,
and then season two, he like has that moment where he like literally fails to deliver Willow's key message.
Oh yes,
at a vital time.
Totally, and
oh my god, I just realized I'm gonna hate him.
Exactly, but in season five. Oh! Later on in this season, when Riley leaves and he gives Buffy shit for it, and I'm like, you son of a bitch. And he has this line where he says something like, or where Buffy says something to him about how her love life is none of his business, and he says something like, well, it used to be. And she doesn't challenge him on it. And I'm like, no! No, you asshole! It was never your business. Your business is your business.
Oh my god.
But anyway, and it's echoed in this episode where they have that whole scene where where Riley and Xander are lecturing Buffy on how she reacts to Dawn, and I'm like, you know what? This is neither of your business. Like, you don't get to tell Buffy how she feels about her sister and bringing Harmony into the house or anything else.
That's the thing. I can't imagine like texting one of you guys and being like, God, I got this problem with my brother or whatever the fuck, and then y'all like. Lecturing me, I would hang up on you. Xander never minds his business. That's his key character trait. I don't mind my business.
But
just
yeah,
for those who do not know about the comics in season 9, Xander and Dawn do end up together.
I know. Yeah. And rewatching this episode, that's all I could think of. I was like, man,
what?
But realistically,
yeah. So what happens is basically in the comics, like Xander and Buffy have a moment where they realize that like they were kind of meant to be together. It's really weird, but like the time has passed. Like they kind of realize that the ship has sailed, and it's at the same moment while Xander is like falling in love with Dawn. I think it's that Xander and Dawn fall in love, and Buffy
gets a little jealous.
Gets jealous and figures out for herself that she has had a thing for Xander forever, but like she. It passed her by.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my god.
Oh my gosh.
Wait, Matthew, did you read the comics?
No, I just read everything that happens in them.
Because I read them. I don't think. She gets a little jealous, but portrayed as like her just getting a little jealous, and she's like, you know, like any idea that we could have had anything together passed away a long, like, was that ship sailed a long time ago. And she,
that's
like,
what I just said. That ship sailed.
But like, she doesn't say like, oh, I had feelings for you or I was in love with you. She just says like
subtext. It's iceberg writing.
See, because here's the thing. I actually think it not only makes sense, but is totally consistent with his character for Xander to go after fucking Dawn.
Well, yes. Speak on that. Yes.
Because that is the kind of dude that he fucking is. And I like, it creeps me out, but it is so believable and it's so real. That
I don't know. Like, if you were friends with someone for years and years, and then all those years later you found out that they, like, secretly liked your sister who he used to babysit, I'd be like, you're fucking gross.
Yes. Yes, it is.
You and your dead ex-demon girlfriend used to babysit this girl.
Okay, wait.
How dare you?
Now you're all going to make me defend Xander. Because, and I'm not happy, but because I know that, and we talked about this, they age them up, but realistically, Dawn isn't that much younger than them.
He's 5, but no, it's not about the age. It's about the fact that he used to babysit her and that he's your best friend's little sister who he used to watch over when he was 14. But now see her as a sexual object.
He has memories of her being 12, being 10, being 9, whatever.
I'm going to reference the show that I don't watch. I'm going to do what Matthew just did. I'm going to reference something I don't watch, but I know you do, Matthew. Isn't that a whole plot in Friends? Doesn't she date, like, Tom Selleck? Or Burt Reynolds? I forget which one. I get those guys mixed up.
Well, she dates Tom Selleck, but Tom Selleck's not related to her. Or they're not, like, friends. He was their family's orthodontist.
But, like, he was so he had been with her since
She had seen him as an orthodontist as a child, but not as a babysitter. He was like a doctor who she saw like once a year as an like I don't even see an orthodontist. I've never seen one in my life, so I don't know how often you see them. But
I also don't stand the two of those people together.
But to really get into it on Friends, after Monica sees Tom, she actually sees his son for an episode. Because she goes to go get her teeth cleaned or something on Thanksgiving, and Tom Selleck's not there, but his son is, and then they go on a date.
Oh, really?
Well,
so here's trying out friends me, Ian.
Here's my thing. It's less about their relationship to each other in terms of older, younger, and more about the fact that Xander was in love with Buffy and obsessed with Buffy and controlling and all that shit, and then he goes for her younger sister. Like, it just...
It's really gross.
Yeah.
We're not saying the age, Ian. I think we're just saying that it's a level of grossness that's gross.
And I will give Xander credit. In the comics, they've definitely matured him a lot. Where, like, I actually really like him in the comics. Like, him and Spike are roommates, and, like, like him a lot better.
Yeah.
Isn't he kind of like Buffy's Watcher in the comics?
Kind of.
Yeah.
Okay. Reasonable role for him, and I could accept that if they had gone that way in the series.
Let's go to Harmony's plan, because the funny thing is, first of all, the Slayer come out and die note kills me every time I look at it.
Yeah,
I was thinking about making it my cover photo. I wanted to make it like my cover photo on Twitter because it's so funny.
It's so perfectly, they do such a good job with Harmony, I think, and
it's the details.
Yeah,
you know? The smiley face above the eye.
It's funny because David Fury said that when he wrote it, it's actually supposed to be a bunch of hearts, like, above her name, not a smiley face. Like, he put that in the script. He was like, oh, in my script, I actually put a bunch of hearts. I don't know why they changed it to a smiley face. But I feel like both work, like...
Yeah. Her makeup is on point,
like, they stole all these books about the Slayer to learn about her, but then their plan happens the same day. And it's like, you did not read those books. You're bad at planning, Harmony. Like, read the books.
Well, she says she skimmed the dust jacket. She's like, there's a lot of really good information in there.
So, obviously, Harmony and Xander get into an altercation because Dawn invites her into the house.
Wait, I want us to talk about Anya discovering capitalism in Layla's life. I feel like
this is the origin story,
right? Mm. I feel like this is them, and I mean, I already love Anya, but I feel like this is when they 100% know where they want to go with that character.
Yeah,
it's that and the magic box.
Yeah, she discovers her love of money. You know, she's like, oh crap. Look at me, I'm losing. I have all these annoying children and all this money. And Xander's like, no, you're winning. And I feel like that's Anya, like, a little switch clicks in her head. And she's like, oh, this is what I want. I want to win at life for my, like, human life.
It's a great, like, connection.
That's a little interesting. That's a little interesting nugget that, like, maybe Anya learned all she needs to know about humanity from the game of life.
Right?
yes, that making money means you're winning, that having more money. I love how she wants to trade the children in for more cash. Yeah. And Dawn is just
She truly had, like, six kids. You can't even fit that many kids in the car.
Yeah. I always hated getting kids when I played that game.
Yeah,
I liked it because you get money at the end of the game for the kids.
The game is a heterosexist and it cherishes children and it literally rewards you for having them and it shits on single people and people who don't want fucking kids.
All right, the three of you. I was the softie who was like, yay, kids. So
I'm like, when am I going to draw the life card that says I end up in a thruple and I have sex parties every week?
I know, yeah. Where's your reward for that?
Yeah. So then you know, Dawn does accidentally invite Harmony in, which in the commentary, they say they, like, were trying to figure out how to get, like, the action to happen, and Joss is one that was like, oh, you're going to have Dawn invite Harmony in since she lives there too. And it was, like, his idea to have that happen. I kind of love everything that's going on in that scene. Like, Xander and her work really well as, like, if, like, we had to pair a villain with each one of the main characters, like, she would be the one I pair with him.
Yeah.
And, you know, because they're both, like, stunted children, she's still,
and eternal, and number twos.
Yeah.
like, she's... Willow is super powerful, Buffy's super powerful, and he'll always be number two to both of them.
Yeah.
Yep.
And he's number two to each other in their friendship. Like, he and Willow have been friends forever, but Willow straight up calls Buffy her best friend all the time.
Kind of like in Primeval, for example. It's like, what is Xander bringing to the table here? like really, honestly, what is he bringing to the table? Nothing.
They have the emotional moment and Xander gets a hug. Like, they have this, like, I think what Ian's picking up on is, like, I think that the writers have the most fun when they're writing Xander and Harmony together.
Yeah. It feels like I enjoy watching it, and I mean, maybe it's the two actors as well. They clearly work off each other pretty well. And once she's in there, I actually really love Anya has like a throwaway line where she's running down the hallway by the stairs and she's like, it's a Slayer's house and I can't even find a weapon, and she picks up a lamp. I feel like that's a really good, like, Anya's annoyed and it's like, why wouldn't the Slayer have weapons all around the goddamn house?
It's true,
right? Like,
she, but also, like, the funny thing is she runs to the kitchen and kitchens are nothing but a repository of weapons, and she returns with nothing.
Harmony runs into Spike, which I love.
Yes.
They don't quite know what to do with Spike at the beginning of the season, and Buffy vs. Dracula, his, like, only scene is saying, yeah, you know, Dracula owes me this much money. And in this, his only scene is running into Harmony, kind of belittling her. And it's very clear, and I mean, Kimberly Ann said this on our episode where we have the first episode where we have Vamp Harmony. She said how, like, it's very clear Harmony reads self-help books and just recites what she's read from them. And I feel like that's very apparent here too, when she's like, you know, I've discovered who I am. I found the real me. Sirens blasting, the title of the episode. But, like, you know, she's trying to stand up for herself and she's really bad at it.
Harmony's like Ingrid Goes West.
Yeah. She just needs a Cordelia. That's what she literally needs.
Yes. I know you. I just want to say one of the funniest moments of this episode to me is when Xander kicks Harmony off of him and it knocks both Harmony and all of her minions off the porch as if he is some Matrix style assassin. Like, the power of his simple kick is too, I think they oversell it a little bit.
Because realistically, Harmony could have killed all of them if we're being like, right?
She could have snapped his neck instantly.
She could have killed him, like, and Anya so quick.
If he had kicked her off of him somehow, she could have just run right back in and slaughtered them all.
Yeah.
Right, but they shut the door and she kind of gives up.
Yeah.
And she goes back. I don't know why, but...
But tracks with Harmony, that she would be like, ugh, and just be annoyed and be like, fine.
Like, if this was me, if I was in Harmony's situation, this might just be like, I'm just mentally way more used to my, like, human limitation. Like, she's new.
Yeah.
Like, I'd be more used to, like, being like, well, this is normally when I'd stop and give up, so, like, this is it. But she doesn't know, like, the limits of her.
Here's my issue, though. In some ways, this episode functions as what Roger Ebert would call an idiot plot, where it depends on the characters behaving like idiots in order to further itself. So it's kind of like Dawn makes a series of elementary mistakes, like things that she... inviting Harmony in, storming outside for no reason in the middle of the night, even though vampires have come to the house looking to kill them all. And she like volunteers herself as bait, basically. And I'm kind of like, I feel like they're asking the audience to say, oh, well, she's a kid and she doesn't know any better. And I know that that's the fuel for the argument that happens between Buffy and, like, literally everybody in this entire episode about how Dawn should know better, and it's absurd that she doesn't. But it is absurd that she doesn't. And it's absurd. Caleb,
that's such a good point, because, like, it is the Ebert idiot plot, but it's also, like, as someone, as you and I both write for teens, so, like, we write these, like, hyper, you know, why is usually critiqued as, like, well, all these teens are, like, hyper confident and they're competent in what they do, like everything they set out to do, they achieve. And it's like, yeah, it's probably closer to that than to the Dawns of the world. Right. Like, they're not, like, people who are 14 even, like, are not going to, especially if they've gone through what they've gone through, are not going to be making these types of mistakes. And I really feel like had they challenged that plot a little bit more and thought up a tougher way to achieve what they wanted to achieve, which is getting Harmony to kidnap Dawn, I think that would have left a better taste in audiences' mouths about Dawn. But I think right out the gate, you're seeing Dawn be, oh my God, she's this relentless baggage, and she's only going to hinder everything that's already happened.
Well, it's also interesting because it feels like, in a way, a betrayal of genre in the moment. Like, yes, Buffy can be funny, but when you're talking about dumbing down your characters, like, you know, there's a saying, or like, there's the rules that dramas show characters as better than they are, or people as better than they are, and comedies show people as worse than they are, and that's why everyone, when you watch a comedy, is usually a little stupid and does things they wouldn't do, and they act against their survival instincts and all that. And it feels a little bit like, you know, we're not in a comedy moment in the show, and like Dawn should be doing some normal human self-preservation things, and she's not doing them. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing, is that I feel like, you know, in the first season, of course, they're sophomores. They're 15, 16, so they're not that much older than Dawn. And they still manage to get themselves into believable trouble without having to do boneheaded things that they should know better. You know, it's such a... I understand the mechanics of needing Dawn to invite Harmony in order to create this next moment. I understand needing to get Dawn in peril in order to facilitate that final confrontation. But I feel like there are more elegant ways to do that. I mean, first of all, just once Harmony has an invite to the house, they don't need Dawn to storm outside, which is such a dumb move.
Yeah.
Have Harmony figure out a way to get into the house again, and she can just abduct her.
Harmony can literally just kick the door open and walk in.
Right.
Or she could, throw in, like, a Molotov cocktail into the window and just force everyone to run out.
But I feel like it literally could have just been, like, Dawn washing a dish at the sink from her pizza and, like, Harmony grabbing her through the window or something.
Exactly.
I do have that in my notes, Caleb. Like, so her inviting her in doesn't bother me, but her storming out of the house really bothers me, because it's like, you live and function in this world where demons, monsters, and vampires are real. A vampire just came to the house, and you're gonna start, like, it literally just happened.
Matthew said, like, it's like, it's not so much like, oh, you know, she shouldn't have done that because everybody told her to stay put. It's like, no, her own natural, like, self-preservation instinct would have kicked in to be like, no, it's dark and scary out there, and so much has happened.
Yeah.
Bad things happen when I leave in the middle of the night. So I'm going to do another dramatic thing.
Like, go up to your room and be dramatic, not go outside.
Right. I'm going to stop at the stairs, or I'm going to cut my hair off. Something. I'm coming up with a lot of crazy ideas right now. I'm a pro at getting attention. But it's definitely like Maddie. Like, this is it's the lack of self-preservation that stings rather than the, oh, she's just not listening to everybody.
Right.
One of my favorite moments in the episode is when Buffy is laughing about Harmony having minions.
Yes.
It's actually one of my favorite moments probably in the whole series for some reason.
Yes. Because it's very hard to get people to fake laugh as actors. Like, I mean, that's to get that sort of real laugh. It's when you see people fake laughing, it's in a scene, like, you can tell. It's very, very rare to get, like, such a genuine, like, this is really tickling everybody.
But I loved that. I loved the way that they played it, where Buffy, of course, thinks it's hilarious that Harmony, of all people, has minions, and this, like she has a crusade against Buffy and wants to kill her, and you even see that Riley, who is a character that I am hot and cold on, mostly cold, but you see how he eventually responds to this, where he's amused by Buffy's amusement, which is so human and so real. Like that moment where he doesn't really know the players, but he sees Buffy's reaction and he starts to laugh too, where he's like, but she wants to kill you. Like, you should take this seriously, but he kind of can't take himself seriously because Buffy finds it so laughable.
Well, I think he really cares about Buffy, and he's also seen her really go through it. So I'm sure he's just relieved to see her kind of like filled with joy, which is a rare sight.
I think in the next episode, her arm is broken, right? Doesn't Anya? Yeah, she gets put in a cast.
Yeah.
That feels a little like a lot for just a punch. Like, they all get punched every episode.
It's true. But
now, judging the way people get their arm broken,
the physics of how injuries work in Buffy
Because, like, then
it's
later...
cute as hell. Like, it...
In Triangle, it, literally, the Olaf picks up Willow and Anya and throws them into a shelving unit, and it, like, shatters. So, like, that would probably break something, but then they're fine. They just, like, get right back
up. Well, you know what's an interesting little thing is that this is the episode where Anya learns about the Game of Life, and then she breaks her arm, and it's, like, this human... back to back, like she literally is learning what it means to be to have a life, and then she gets her arm broken.
That's a very good point. This episode actually lays foundation for a few character journeys. Like, you definitely see the fissures beginning to appear in Buffy and Riley's relationship in this episode.
Well, in that walkabout, Aaron Sorkin moment that Buffy and Riley have, doesn't Riley begin to show that he resents Buffy a little bit?
Yes, I think so.
Well, there's also that moment where he makes plans with her and she forgets about them.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And also, we didn't discuss the outfit that she's wearing when he makes those plans, with like that varsity shirt that's like cut with the rope on the back and the skirt and how hideous it is.
I love it. Are you kidding me?
That is literally the most pedestrian. Like, that is something. I said pedestrian about her outfit last episode too. And what I want to say is that in this season, she dresses like someone who is walking through a New Jersey mall, and I'm someone from New Jersey, and Tyra Banks always calls this out on ANTN. Like, she's dressing like one of those girls who's really pretty, and her hair is pedestrian too. Like, she needs to cut it and elevate it. She's dressing and has hair like a New Jersey mall girl.
Okay,
and she needs to edge herself out.
I take exception to the hair comment. I think her hair is on point. In
this
season
whole
five.
Season, I think it's her best hair season.
Everyone loves Buffy season 5 hair, but I think it's just common mall hair.
She went to
Supercuts and got it done.
The podcast is canceled forever.
I think the hair and the jewelry in season 5 are on point. I love like the dangly, the lariat necklaces and the big hoop earrings.
She looks so good at hoops.
Yes.
I think we're seeing the early 2000s fashion curse come home to roost with this, because I think in the time it was like, oh, hot hip, and then now that we're watching it, now the time has passed, it's like, oh wow, this is some Jessica Simpson.
But here's the thing, is like, I just love the devil may care attitude of season 4 to hair and fashion and everything. And as the series progresses, she begins to look like she's shopping at like Ann Taylor Loft all the time.
Well, they're aging her in 5, 6, 7, and they eventually in season 7 acknowledge this, and they say, wow, she's basically a mom, even though she's 21.
But I
Buffy,
feel like
I would not have raised you from the dead if I knew you were gonna shop like that. Okay.
I think that seasons 2 and 3 are her most like fashion forwardy seasons, because season 1, come on, she had this like,
oh yeah.
Well, it was season 1, but season 3 is my favorite for both fashion and hair, because she always is wearing like a dress to school, and it's like a beautiful dress. It's like a little LBD or something, and like it's like going to fifth period in my beautiful dress. It's like, girl. No.
She had a series of good dresses, the little clutches, she had the chunky highlights.
It was season great.
Season 3 is where it's at. But she had hair. Her flowy hair in season 5, it lended action to the scenes.
It does. She has hairography. I learned that from Glee.
Yes, yes, precisely. Anyway, but that's beside the point. We're talking about something else.
Well, let's go to the whole last act, which is the Harmony plot.
So I love that literally Dawn says, "Touch me and my sister is going to kill you," and Tom like touches her and then dies.
And then he dies. And
well, the funny thing, so one of the failures I think of this episode, which actually I think does a lot of really good stuff, is that, gosh, land this plane, Matthew, you know what you're gonna say. Gosh. Earlier Caleb said Harmony is the one who actually says the title of the plot, the title of the episode and the real me, and it's weird, they kind of have Harmony and Dawn as like mirrors of each other, as like underappreciated people, but it doesn't really map onto itself, because Harmony's talking about I'm the one with all the plans and they don't appreciate me, and Dawn is not that, but like they're trying to map it. But it's funny, because more so than we realize, they try to do that with Harmony, because that was the same thing they were doing in The Harsh Light of Day, trying to say that Harmony's relationship with Spike was similar to Buffy's with Parker and Anya's with Xander. So they use Harmony to make these not judgments, but they use harmony to do like character growth moments that don't always work, but it's actually really interesting that they bring in harmony to do them.
I think that in my opinion, it's sort of like they have two moments in this episode where Dawn has the two of us, you know, we girls, we see eye to eye, and one is with Tara and one is with Harmony. And I think that she is sort of a balance of both, because she's of course, she's not a villain like Harmony, and she's not like an incompetent leader in the way that Harmony is. But she is that sort of annoying peripheral character who is constantly trying to be noticed and trying, sort of currying for approval. And and with Tara, they are both also they are good characters who have heart and, you know, are well-intentioned and want to, or I think definitely Dawn wants to be recognized as a part of the Scooby crew, even if she hasn't expressed it in this episode yet. I don't know that Tara necessarily wants to be included as a Scooby, but she is in effect and is underappreciated as such. So I can totally see where Dawn sees eye to eye with both of these characters to a certain degree, but I think more it's the parallel with Harmony, is that Harmony is kind of this, like, her function is as an annoying thorn in the side, and so is Dawn to Buffy. It's just that Buffy has affection for Dawn, and the viewer has affection for Harmony.
I mean, that does actually make sense. And they both say the real me.
Yes.
Because Harmony says it, and then Dawn says it at the end. Or does Dawn say it in the beginning? I can't even remember.
I think she says it at the beginning and sort of at the end.
Okay. And so, in the commentary, he says, "There goes Tom, to be reborn next season as Andrew," is what David Fury says. I love,
and the guy goes, "Huh? What? Who?"
I always think of this as in season 4, but it's this episode. And Harmony's like, "At long last we meet," and Buffy's like, "We've met, you halfwit."
it's such a great moment.
And then, you know, I almost feel bad that we don't get, like, Harmony deserves this fight with the Slayer, but I guess, like, even we the viewers know that if she fought Buffy, she would lose and die, so we can't have
It would still be a fight. Like, I mean, it's because they always are, like, wishy-washy on how powerful vampires are. But, like, we see, like, in conversations with dead people, she has a pretty difficult fight with, like, a just-born vampire.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And Harmony's been training.
Yeah, and in this episode, she has a difficult fight with Mort.
Yeah.
Mort. I think, aren't they hinting that, like, her and Mort have, like, a sexual thing together?
Yeah.
Because I think that, like, it's very, the sexual dynamics of the vampire commune are very interesting, because at one point someone thinks that when they say we're going to do it tonight that she mistakes it for them having sex and she says no. But, like, I'm sure vampires are not as into monogamy as the rest of the world is, as the human world. And I feel like when you're a vampire, everyone would just have sex anyway. I don't know. But I feel like they're hinting that her and Mort are definitely boinking.
Yeah. Oh, I think so, too.
I agree. Yeah.
Mort.
I know. What a good name.
Great.
I would never let someone named Mort inside me.
Listen.
Matthew, you never know.
Everybody has to have some standards.
If Mort can pay my bills, he can, like, get right inside of me, sure.
You're going to be, like, approached by this Michael B. Jordan-looking guy by the name of Mort tomorrow, and it's going to be like, oh, shit, I was mistaken.
Well, I said he couldn't go inside me, so I would just top.
Oh, that's shit, yeah.
But he's a strict top. That's the twist, Matthew.
Okay. No one's a strict top once you lick their butt, Ian.
Facts are facts.
Yeah.
Facts, America.
I'm a virgin. Let's keep moving. So she has the fight. She wins. I get what they're doing by having her cover for Dawn, but I kind of feel like Dawn deserved to get in trouble for this. Don't you?
Oh, I agree. I agree, but part of the issue, part of the reason why I think that Dawn deserved to get in trouble for this is because part of it is my issue with Joyce in this episode, where it's sort of like she really is giving Dawn an unrealistic and unreasonable amount of slack. And like constantly, oh, you know, like how could you, how, you know, I have, my life is so challenging and I've got all these things I have to do. And all I asked of you was one thing, take Dawn shopping. And instead you took her to a dead body. And it's like, do you, have you met your daughter? Like, have you met Buffy? Do you know what her entire life is like? Like, you've had multiple conversations about this in past episodes about how she literally cannot stay away from dead bodies. And that's her responsibility. And she's like, I have to go out and patrol for vampires because that's what I do. And she's like, all I asked you to do was this one thing, which is babysit your daughter 24 hours a day. And you won't even do that. And I'm like, Joyce?
Joyce. Well, because here's the thing. This is a really, in this way, it is a really well-written teen story because the main character is the only one who is not an impossible person. Like, the mom, the daughter, the sister, the friends, the everybody has moments of like, why are you acting like this? And it just, every time someone acts that way, just behaves horribly. It only emboldens Buffy's character more. Like, the more everyone else just is a screw up, the better for Buffy.
I both agree and disagree with you. She's definitely, like, the most reasonable, but I actually feel like this is the beginning of this huge character change for Buffy that I don't think the audience ever really will get on board with, where, like, she has to be this, like, no-fun mom, you know? Yeah. Like, this episode is the first where you really see her stressing over Dawn so much. And, like, I mean, I understand it because my sister... So they're, like, 5 years apart at this point. My sister and I were 7 years apart. And I didn't have, a father in my house. So it was the same kind of dynamic where, like, it felt like it was... They were, like, my mom and my sister were co-parenting me. And so my sister became, like, that no-fun teenager really early... Like, at 19 when I was 12. Or, you know, like, that no... So, like, but it's not... anywhere that like we would have thought at season 4 that we would have seen Buffy have to become this like no fun mom so quickly. Like I would have loved to see her a little bit more have like fun sister time. Like I don't even think there's a scene in the whole series at all where it's just like fun sister time with Dawn.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's a great point. I think that would have one scene like that in this episode showing Buffy and Dawn having like an inside joke, having some kind of like a real fun sisterly moment where they actually get along. It would have made a huge difference the way that viewers accepted Dawn as a character.
Even if they just bonded over Joyce being annoying over something.
That is an interesting point, Caleb, because really we want Buffy to, like, as the viewer and as the person we trust the most, like, we want Buffy to sign off on Dawn, and the show won't give us that.
Yeah.
Like, she always seems annoyed by Dawn, and we want to know, we know that she loves her through her actions of protecting her, but we want to know that she loves her through the action of, like, laughing with her.
Exactly. That's the thing, is that it in her language, Buffy talks about Dawn like she's this huge burden, and in a way, she is, but it's also kind of like, yeah, you need that softer moment.
Like, we signed on, and that's the interesting thing as you go into 5, 6, and 7 and how much it changes, and, like, I love 6 and 7, but they are so different, and it's like, we did sign on for a teen show about high school as hell, and then we were down for college, but, like, are we down for Buffy as surrogate mom, you know?
Yeah,
right. Yes. That's the thing. It's there might be some realisticness to it, like you said, but like it is like a, should we do it this way? Like it just it definitely takes the story in a more tired direction. Have the main character be more tired.
Well, that's tired is such a good word because it does feel like we the viewers are just like peering into single momdom in a way that we weren't when Buffy was the kid and Joyce was the single mom.
Right.
In a way that, like, now your character, especially, like, you know, after Joyce dies, spoiler alert, but, the way we have to explore single momdom with Buffy, like, it's like she's Buffy the Slayer and Buffy the single mom.
Right.
Like, I think, like, in a alternative future or a possible future where Buffy gets a revival... like, then, yeah, that's perfectly the time to be like, well, let's look at what being a Slayer is and being the super put-upon mom with bills to pay and this to do.
that's kind of, I mean, we're going really, I myself am going really far afield, and I'll apologize to our dear listeners. Maybe this will get cut. But that's kind of what's interesting about when Buffy dies and, like, Tara and Willow move in, and, like, it feels like the whole gang gets together to take care of Dawn. But when Buffy was alive, no one helped. She was, like, on her own. It's like Willow and Tara could have been moved in.
Right?
Yep. No,
I mean, yeah, that's the thing, is that they do sort of immediately present this, I don't know, I was saying this while we were on our break, but the choice to make Dawn immediately this kind of annoying, bratty character who is a constant thorn in Buffy's side and a constant, like, the stone of triumph that she has to lug around with her. It's a bold, that's a lot of choice, because it sets up this vibe, and at the time, watching it when it was first on, a lot of people just did not want to deal with Dawn as a character, because they didn't make her fun. They introduced her as this weird, it's like all of a sudden you're just submerged in this storyline where people are accepting Dawn as a character.
But yeah.
But she's not presented as a breath of fresh air, and she's not presented as this kind of, like, fun, witty character. She's not presented as a reward. She's a burden. She's Buffy's punishment. She is this new thing that Buffy has to deal with that complicates her life, that makes things harder. And she becomes a weapon that Joyce uses against Buffy. She becomes something that Buffy's friends scold her about. And I know that a lot of this is foreshadowing, because you see how the relationships between Buffy and her friends complicate over the course of this season. It's all about Buffy growing up. It's all about Buffy sort of leaving behind her childhood and entering her adulthood. I get all of that, but there just needed to be softer moments in order to make it work better.
Yeah.
I think that's really interesting, and I think it's interesting to think about, like, what it means to introduce a new character to a series, the way that they introduced, or not the way that they introduced Dawn, but the way that, like, she immediately takes over the whole show and it becomes the Dawn show in a way.
Yeah.
Because before that, it felt like all the characters had things going on that were about them. Like, Willow had her whole coming out story. You know, Xander didn't have a great storyline, but, like, they could have given him a better one, and Buffy had stuff going. It felt like everyone had stuff going on, but once Dawn comes on the scene, like, it feels like actually a lot of the characters don't have their own stuff anymore, and it all becomes about her. And I can't think of another show where they introduce a character that so dominates the storyline without any other, like, credence to any of the characters.
It's a Cousin Oliver moment where she comes in, and it is like her function in the story is as Buffy's little sister. She has no separate plot line except for she's Buffy's sister, and it's her position in the story is given to us by how Buffy feels about her, how Buffy relates to her, how Buffy reshapes her life to accommodate Dawn. And then later, when we find out Dawn's significance in the overall plot of season 5, but we don't get to know Dawn's friends. We don't get to know, she doesn't have a boy that she crushes on, or a girl, or whoever.
They try
to do that in season 7, and I think it works in that one episode, Lessons, and I wish they had continued with it, but they kind of just, you know, in season 7 there's a lot that they kind of just drop, but I think that would have been something nice to see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, in The Body, we see her at school, because you see that whole thing, like, which I think,
and she has
I
a friend.
Wish they'd done before, like, because it's like, oh, okay, here's the, you know, she's in class, she's in art, she's good at art, whatever, like, just doing anything besides she stands there and screams and is a burden.
Right.
That's how I feel. So that's on, me. I scream.
On that
I'm
note.
Continue.
On that note, let's wrap things up, Ian.
Yes. Favorite outfit, Adam.
Oh God, I think just anything Harmony wears. I mean, just like everything in there. Like, I think, like, the little unicorn accessory, which is A+.
Caleb.
I actually I'm going to agree with Adam. I think that my favorite outfit is the one that Harmony wears, which is the sleeveless kind of like turtlenecky sort of thing, or like
mock-turtle,
whatever it is. And she's got like the gold, I don't know if it's a necklace or if it's part of the shirt, but these like drapey, like gold ropes that come off it.
She's wearing like a Sex and the City like side character costume.
Totally. No. And she's got the flowy hair and she's got the red lip and her look was on point. I like that. Yeah.
Matthew?
My answer is long. Deal with it, because I'm going to talk about all the fashion that I want to talk about. I just love that they started putting Willow in "Yes, I am a Wiccan, ask me how" outfits, and this is like the beginning of it. Like she's wearing that cutoff thing with like basically a spell written on it in like spell language, like spell font. And then I already talked about how I hate that Buffy outfit that needs to burn, but I'm actually going to go for a dumb outfit, but it's the one that Dawn wears when Xander comes over, because one of the cute little jokes about this episode is that she changes her outfit to impress Xander, and we have to respect a costume change.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But she literally like puts something on to be like, ooh, I'm gonna impress Xander, and like, girl, same.
All right, well, my favorite is, I like the Buffy in her dark denim jacket with the pinkish beige top and the hoops and her hair up. I think she looks great. favorite scene, Caleb.
All right. My favorite scene, it's a toss up between either Harmony's speech to her minions or the moment between Tara and Willow where Tara is trying to make Willow acknowledge how hard things are for Dawn. Specifically because that was the moment that I think that we really needed for this episode, where a character that the viewers love expresses sympathy for Dawn. Because I think I understand why they balanced it so that Buffy was sort of constantly riding Dawn and constantly annoyed by her. But I think we needed a character to really come in and say, but honestly, let's think about how hard it is for her. Mm. So those are my two faves.
I was saying literally something the opposite of Caleb. So my because here's the thing: you all are younger siblings.
Yes,
I am the oldest sibling, so I relate to this episode in a very different way than y'all. So first, I love this. My favorite moment is the "We meet again, we've met before" moment. Just up and away. And second favorite, I just really like the initial sort of just like, I do enjoy the scenes where Joyce is really being unfair to Buffy about watch your sister, you should have watched out better. Like, it is annoying as to a viewer, but it is perfectly realized as this happens to me a lot, or happened to me a lot.
Matthew?
My favorite scene is probably the banter between Harmony and Xander, because it's so well done.
Right.
But shout out to Anya playing life.
My favorite is Anya, Xander, and Dawn playing life, and Anya just being like, crap, and like freaking out and learning about capitalism. I love it all. All right, great in the episode. Adam?
I would give this, I'm gonna give it an A. I like it. Okay. I think this episode sets out to do a very specific thing. It had a very hard, thankless task ahead of it, and I think it accomplished it very well. I like the voiceover. The voiceover is very 1989, 2000. Everybody was all about voiceover at that time.
Yeah, that's true.
It was the thing to do. It was, fuck you if you don't do a voiceover at that point. So I think this was their way to, like, it was not frowned upon. So I'm not going to ding that at all. I think it works. A. All right.
Caleb.
I am going to give this episode, I think, an A-B+. Okay. Like, I remember watching it the first time, it was not memorable. Watching it the second time, there were things about it that I I appreciated more than I did the first time. I actually really, I remember Harmony not making that much of an impression the first time, and this time I really liked her. I liked what she brought to the episode. It was a good kind of moment of just the kind of sheer old school Buffy enjoyment that, yeah, where there's this sort of like, I don't know, this kind of schismatic energy with all the stuff where, because Dawn sort of gets thrust into the story and it really controls everything, and it's this weird energy between the characters. Anyway, and I think there were just a couple of things that I would have tweaked as if they'd let me in the writing room. So A minus, B plus.
I think Harmony is the breath of fresh air that Dawn is not.
Yes.
Matthew?
I'm going to give this episode a B. I think that it does some things successfully and other things not that successfully, but I also want to give it a B because even though I feel like it's not that successful, I also think that it's not that ambitious, that it's just a regular episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So I don't want to judge it too harshly, so I'm just going to say it's in solid B territory, but it's flirting with B minus.
Got it.
I 100% agree with you, Matthew. I think I try to be fair because I think it's on purpose supposed to be just a regular episode of Buffy, because it's like, hey, look, there's this new character. We don't know what's going on with her, but then we're showing like a very basic, you know, Harmony's clearly not a threat to Buffy. Even when she captures Dawn, there's never like a Harmony.
Stakes aren't high.
Yeah, like, yeah, the stakes aren't high. I think it's all on purpose.
It's a filler episode. It is definitely a getting business accomplished.
Yeah.
They know that, yeah, it's the season premiere is the one that gets the ratings. We're not in sweeps. We're just trying to lay some groundwork.
Yeah. Exactly. Matthew, by the way, flirting with B minus is my brand, so
flirting with B minus yet still not getting a number is my brand.
Yes. Mother, may I sleep with
dating? No. Mother,
may I sleep with mediocrity?
My dating life.
Memoir titles, all of it.
Thanks for being on, guys, and thank you for listening, everyone. If you want to follow SlayerFest98 on Twitter, we are at SlayerFestX98. If you want to follow Matthew, he is at Matthew Rodriguez, one T, a G, and a Z.
If you want to follow Ian, he's on Twitter at IanXCarlos. And if you want to follow Adam, where are you?
I am at the Adam Sass on Twitter.
And Caleb?
I am at M-I... Okay. I am...
Been waiting to do it.
Exactly. I'm Mike Caleb Rarig, but it's M-I-K-A-L-E-B R-O-E-H-R-I-G.
I feel like you could make a little song ditty out of the way that your name rhymes, like M-I-C-K-E-Y-M-O-U-S-E or something.
I know.
Like, if you try really hard, I think you could do it.
I will. For my next appearance, now that I'm a Scooby, I assume the invite is now implied.
Yeah.
I'll just show up the next time you guys are recording. You won't even know it. I'll just appear.
I feel like you're here in spirit all the time anyway.
So. Yay!
All right, guys, and we'll see everyone next week. Bye!
Bye-bye.
Bye!
Bye!